This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
New science finds home to billions of humans now living could become uninhabitable due to climate change. Some plants, as we know, only live within narrow temperature bands. But now we learn that is possibly true of humans as well. But temperatures are changing, the planet is warming. In fact, people living during the next 50 years will see changes greater than in any human history. Professor Timothy Lenton is director of the Global Systems Institute at UK's University of Exeter. He returns to Radio EcoShock as co-author of a benchmark paper published this May in the journal Nature. It's called Future of the Human Climate Niche. Beyond the startling headlines, we find a new understanding of humans and where we live. Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me back, Alex.
Well, this paper got headlines in the European and American press, saying billions of people will find themselves in extreme heat zones. Could global warming really take us beyond our tolerance levels so soon?
That's the worrying conclusion we've had to come to from doing this work. It's not the case for everybody, but it's the case for large numbers of often already vulnerable people that they will be set to experience climates that hardly anyone or even no one experiences today on the hot end. And, yeah, we were quite flabbergasted with the kind of numbers that were coming out of our analysis.
Well, let's delve into the fundamental concept of a human niche. How do you define that?
Well, what inspired our study, I suppose, was a sort of question an ecologist would ask, which is, are humans just like any other animal in the sense that they have a preferred range of climates, temperatures and rainfalls at which they like to live? I mean, we don't find elephants on the ice sheets and we don't find penguins in the savannah. We, of course, find humans all over the planet, but not at the same population density. I mean, the population density is very low if you're an Inuit in the Arctic or indeed a pastoralist on the edge of the Sahara, for example. So what we did was we looked carefully in available data at what is the population density of people as a function of temperature and of rainfall. And we were quite stunned by the results, which is that there's a clear peak in human population density centered on about 13 degrees centigrade mean annual temperature. There's a secondary peak of density of people living mostly in the Indian subcontinent in hotter and wetter conditions. There's quite a gap in the middle. There's not a lot of population density around 20 degrees centigrade on the annual average, which in a European context is like the north coast of Africa. And of course, the population density drops off at really low temperatures and really high temperatures. And there's hardly anywhere on the surface of the Earth that goes above about 29 degrees centigrade on the annual average. And one of the issues we looked at with the future was how climate change is going to push many people, potentially billions of people, to be living out at the top end at temperatures greater than 29 degrees C.
You and your co-authors say that while some places will become as hot as the Sahara Desert is today, other regions could actually develop a more habitable climate. Can you give us some examples?
So what we're thinking about here is the idea that the best conditions, if they're indeed defined as, say, 13 degrees centigrade on the annual average, those conditions are moving poleward in a simple sense, and they're sort of moving up mountains where mountains exist. So I guess if you thought about it in the Americas, it's like shift in what's currently the optimum is moving from somewhere in the US, possibly across or approaching the Canadian border, certainly.
I took a look, and first of all, you're talking about 13 degrees C. For our North American listeners, that's a mean annual temperature in the mid-50s Fahrenheit. And looking at your map, it looks like there are winners and losers. I thought, by the end of the century, everybody will be up in northern Canada or Siberia, but that's not what your map shows. It just shows it moving from, say, the American South as a good peak area up into the northern states of the U.S., and again, northern Europe is a good thriving zone, but southern Europe will not be.
Exactly. Yeah, that's certainly right in the European case, which I know better. So it's not like we're talking about there not being the land available, because the Earth has a strange kind of geography as we know it today, with a lot of land in the northern high latitudes. But we are potentially talking about pretty large shifts in population density and therefore in large numbers of people. And we're talking about major issues for a continent like Africa, where most population growth is projected to occur in sub-Saharan Africa, which is obviously already a pretty hot place. And countries like Nigeria in West Africa, projected to have huge population growth, they would have large areas of the country going to those temperatures not seen anywhere today of greater than 29 degrees C. And when we look over in India, we get the same problem, that large parts of the Indian subcontinent would be projected to go to these currently unexperienced temperatures.
Tim Linton, what is environmental determinism and why do you hope to avoid it?
I think environmental determinism is academics' terminology for the proposition that we're all, I guess, simply slaves to environmental conditions and that all we can do is kind of track those conditions. Clearly, we're gifted by evolution the capacity to have foresight, to adapt in all sorts of ways to challenges that come to us, be they climatic or otherwise. And we've constructed a whole economy and ways of life that at some level we would like to think give us an option, you know, to get us out of trouble as the climate is changing. But of course, not everybody has the same means to adapt or to cope with these climate challenges. Not everyone has the riches and the luxury. But yeah, what we want to avoid is an overly simple message that just because the climate changes, inevitably all the people who experience an unusual climate will do X or Y, where X might be choose to migrate, for example. Of course, that is logically going to be one of the obvious responses, and it's one of the ways in which we are very adaptable as a species. When things get bad, if we can, we often choose to move to what we think is a better place.
And we'll talk more about that as we get going here, but I also want to cover the fact that a school of European historians used to say that soil fertility determined whether civilizations thrived or fell. Soil depletion was supposed to explain the demise of Rome in the ancient world. In your wide-ranging survey, what did you find about that?
That's a great question, because we're actually continuing the work we started with this, and we're trying to understand how the rise and fall of ancient civilizations is or isn't correlated with climate and other conditions. So that's a little bit of a work in progress. But one thing to note is that ancient civilizations overwhelmingly appeared not in the optimal conditions. They tend to have arisen in relatively dry conditions. If you think of the first city-states of the Near East, modern-day Iraq and Syria, or indeed you think of the Greeks and the Romans in the Mediterranean, they're on the hotter, drier side of the climate niche. But as civilizations have developed, apparently the bulk of population density has been at cooler conditions than that and generally wetter conditions. So we continue to work on that, but it's clear that when you think about civilization, it's best to think of it as a complex system with its own internal processes, almost like an organism, its own cycle of life, if you like. As classicists have often argued, there's a sort of possibly a natural lifetime to civilizations or a natural phases of birth and growth and decay. But there is also, apparently, as far as we can see, some influences coming from the climate and how it sets conditions, as you said, for soil and for growing plants and so on. But I personally think that from what we've done so far, that there was something about challenging conditions climatically that probably triggered the rise of complex society. My view is people in those challenging conditions could only kind of solve the problems of existence by coming together and forming kind of new levels of organization, new kinds of infrastructure, for example, to manage scarce water resources. And that's what we now see, looking back on it, as sort of beginnings of civilization.
Right, even like the aqueduct going into Rome. So in earlier centuries, too, major cities like New York or Paris depended largely on food generated in their surrounding hinterland, as it was called. And now cities get food from all over the world, arriving from thousands of miles away. Does that disconnect from local agriculture affect your study?
Great question again, because we actually chose to analyze not just where people are living, but where does food production peak? Where are domestic animals kept in terms of these climate dimensions of temperature and rainfall? And we actually find that crop production and livestock rearing have the same kind of peaks of density, if you like, density of crops, density of livestock as humans do, even though there is, as you said, quite a lot of trade on the global market of food and commodities. The truth with the food system is it's a sort of halfway house between a globalized market and a sort of national desire to be somewhat food self-sufficient, which remains an echo of the 20th century world wars, really. Even if we imagined a truly globalized food economy, it would appear that just as there is for humans, there's a preferred niche for our food supply, as it were, and that also is destined to move as the climate changes. So from a North American perspective, it's like picturing the grain belt, again, marching northwards.
Yes, officially the worst predictions for global mean temperature by 2070 or so are maybe 2 degrees C of warming. Dr. Lenton, why do you and your co-authors suggest billions of people will experience 7.5 degrees C temperature rise compared to the year 1700? How is that possible?
So what we did was we took a reference global climate change of about 3 degrees of warming in centigrade. And the reason we chose that was actually because that's what our nations are currently committed to, inverted commas, in terms of their contributions that they propose to make to the Paris Agreement on climate change. Those contributions are not that strong at the moment, and those commitments add up to about a little bit over 3 degrees of global warming. So we thought, okay, let's map out what that looks like for where people live. And two factors come into play there. One is that when the world as a whole warms by 3 degrees centigrade, most of the world is ocean, and it warms up less than the land, and we live on the land. So typically, the land are warm in a 3-degree warmer world. It depends where you are, but it might warm 5 degrees centigrade on land, and it'll warm more nearer the poles than at the equator. But there's a second thing going on, which is where does the average person live? Population growth is overwhelmingly projected to be in already hot places, so particularly sub-Saharan Africa. So what's happening is that the distribution of people with respect to temperature is, we would say, statistically skewing to higher temperatures, because all the new people being born are being born into already hot places. So those two effects combined, the land warms up more than the global average, but also the distribution of people shifts to the hotter places. That means that the average person in the 3-degree warmer world, we looked at 50 years into the future, the average person is living about 7.5 degrees centigrade warmer conditions than the average person today.
Let's talk about a case that many of our listeners might be familiar with. A radio colleague and her husband found their old home in Washington, D.C. had become too hot and humid over the years. They were aware of predictions about climate change. The couple moved to Wisconsin to find a better climate. Will world migration be that simple as the climate heats up?
Would that it were so, in a sense. I think for the people that have the means and the desire to migrate, if the borders are welcome or the recipient countries that they might have to move to welcome them, then fine, they can choose to move and they will move, and that's always been the case in recent human history. A lot of migration could occur within country if the country is big enough and spans a big enough range of climates. And of course, the US is a case in point, which already spans a huge range of climates, especially when you count in Alaska. But for many people in the world, they're living in a nation that has much less of a climate range. And the projections that we've made would suggest that to get back to preferred or desirable conditions would have to mean leaving your country you currently live in. And that's where, for me, all sorts of questions and humanitarian concerns arise, because we're clearly living in a world now where the trend of late has rather been towards the closing of borders against migrants rather than the welcoming of a new migrant labour force. So it's hard for me not to conclude with a kind of sense of sadness that the kind of numbers of people that might be triggered to migrate from the climate change that we've analysed, that's going to trigger all kinds of social conflict, unfortunately.
So until this year, many people that I know just assumed the world is headed towards the dreaded RCP 8.5, the worst case, business as usual, rapid hothouse. But we don't have business as usual during this pandemic. In a couple of quick months, emissions have been slashed in ways that seemed unlikely or even impossible. So talk to us about the differences you found with RCP 2.6 and the worst-case climate projections for this century. What difference could it make?
Well, this is where the good news story comes in, because roughly speaking, each extra degree centigrade of warming displaces around a billion people outside of the historical and present climate niche. So each degree centigrade of warming we could save by slashing emissions could save a huge amount of human disruption, and let's put it that way. And so in the best case scenario, which we're still a long way from, but if we could limit global warming to about 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial, which will be a heroic effort, and it's not the trajectory we're on yet, but if we could do it, contrasting that with the scenario we centered on in the paper, this sort of high emissions, high warming, 3 degrees warmer world, the difference in terms of the number of people whose lives are not disrupted, who are not put outside the climate niche, then numbers in the billions. Potentially you could restrict the disruption to less than a billion people rather than it affecting over 3 billion people.
But Tim, isn't it likely the world will still warm by at least 4 degrees, even if we slow down emissions and the rate of change, but it might just happen 100 or 200 years later?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very valid point, Alex, that the only way to stop warming is to stop the emissions completely, and that's extremely difficult to do. So actually what it amounts to is having to have technologies to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere at fairly large scales alongside stopping most of the emissions. And we can't yet claim with our hands on our hearts that we have those technologies in a workable form at the scale required. But there's reasons to believe we could get there if we had the will to get there. But there is, as you say, the counter-argument that if we do anything, we might just slow things down. But as you say, then we could still be creeping up to these temperatures later. And all that would do is buy us time to try and, I'm trying to think of the right word, just adapt, absorb this kind of large-scale movement of people and reimagining of the future world.
But Tim Lenton, this paper does not include two other key climate-related drivers of human migration, extreme weather and sea level rise. Both can make very large areas uninhabitable. Why not include those?
So we obviously think those factors are important, and we weren't attempting, when we set out to do the study, to do a comprehensive analysis of all the factors, climate or otherwise, that might disrupt or displace people. We were actually originally motivated really just to establish whether there was a climate niche for people based on the present-day data and back to 6,000 years ago, all the data we could get from archaeology and so on. And having established that there was a climate niche, it seemed logical to ask how that niche would move in the future. But for sure, if you wanted a comprehensive analysis of all the things that might trigger people to move related to the climate, then yes, you'd want to include not just the change in the mean or average state, but the change in the extreme events. And yes, for sure, bringing sea level rise and the threat it poses to many megacities that are near sea level would be important to do as well.
To my mind, a key to your findings is deceptively simple, and it might go back to our look at environmental determinism. You make some effort to say that migration numbers that will actually happen during the next 50 years cannot simply be figured out according to raw changes in temperature. Why is that?
I say that, and we say that, because it's a complex set of influences and factors that affect whether people choose to migrate or not. I mean, in today's world, it's more about carrot than about stick. It's about people will choose to migrate because they have a sense of a better life or a better opportunity somewhere else. And if they've got the means to get to somewhere else, maybe they will choose to do that. But there's many influences on them. It might be, have they got a family member who's had a positive experience of migrating to the place they're thinking about going to? Have they got the economic means to do the migration? And all of these kind of human factors alongside any underlying drivers, including the climate ones. So there's a rich literature on this topic of environmental change and migration, and there are very vociferous arguments, in the academy at least, over these issues. So I guess it's a bit like the question about the rise and fall of past civilizations. The best way to think about the migration decisions or not of people is to think about people as complex beings with all sorts of influences on them, and to accept that, okay, for some, the climate trigger or stick will be so sharp that it might force migration if they have the means to do it. And that'd be a sad state of affairs, but that might be the case. But for many others, it will sit within this complex of other influences on their life's choices, if you like.
Yes, I'm reminded we interviewed the American author Stan Cox, who told our listeners the internal migration south to the American Sun Belt could not be maintained without air conditioning. So a trigger for mass migration within a country may not be the heat directly, but possibly something like a massive failure of the electric power grid. The trigger might be some social or technical development rather than a heat wave per se.
Yes, I think that's a very valid perspective. That, of course, we like to think of technology as kind of offering the opportunity to insulate ourselves from the climate. But one of the most extraordinary findings I've seen in the literature of late is where economists or econometricians looked at labor productivity and other things as a function of climate. So a different study to our own, but it found, not only did it find the same optimum temperature for economic productivity of 13 degrees centigrade and annual average temperature, but these studies also found that even when people work in air-conditioned buildings or air-conditioned factories, when it's, for example, hot and sunny outside, labor productivity drops. So there's clearly many subtle factors going on that can give this climate influence on our lives. And yes, technology could give us the capacity to live in the most extraordinary climates, and it already does. And of course, it gives us, some lucky people, the capacity to go into space temporarily, you know, to the International Space Station or whatever. But the crucial questions come around cost and how much technology, and if you are going to have the technology to live in an increasingly inhospitable climate on Earth, where's your food coming from, and who's bringing it to you, and all of these questions. And then the answer usually becomes, well, if you're rich enough, you can pretty much do anything. But the point is, we don't live in a world of equality where everybody can imagine being that rich. Instead, we live in a world where inequality and wealth gaps have grown, and the great majority of people don't have that luxury. And I'm afraid I don't see on current trends, sadly, the possibility that they will have that luxury in a few decades' time.
And despite all these things that we're talking about, Tim Lenton, do you personally believe that a mass migration beyond anything seen in human history will happen during this century due to climate change?
I believe it could happen. I sincerely hope it won't happen. And to do what we can to minimize the chance of it happening, the simplest thing to do is to limit the amount of climate change. Well, I say the simplest thing to do. I mean, it's not proving simple to do, but I mean, the obvious thing to do is to try to still strive towards fundamentally tackling the underlying climate problem. If we continue to fail on that, then for me, based on the work I've done, I can't avoid the conclusion that we're going to possibly see movements of people on the scale we've never seen. And then one has to hope for a new kind of political and social maturity, because human migration can be a great thing. It can mean a new labor force, and it can boost the economy in lots of positive ways. But you have to have the politics to go with that, the politics and the society that welcomes diversity and incoming migrants to make a better future together. And okay, some nations in the world can pride themselves on having that approach and that attitude right now, but there's some ones that can't, and that's the political reality we live in.
As we wrap up here, Tim, what else would you like to see get nailed down by science to get some of the blur reduced in these uncertainties for the new paper?
There are always many scientific things one could refine, but actually the thing I've been thinking about with this work is, can it help shift the way that we approach the climate problem? What I mean by that is, like many things in our Western society, an economic analysis of any given problem always seems to be the dominant approach. So when it came to climate change, for decades now, we've had different camps of economists basically arguing over how costly is it going to be when the climate changes, versus how costly or not is it going to be to tackle climate change. And we can debate that till the cows come home. But at the top level, maybe what the current coronavirus crisis is showing us is that we don't always have to evaluate every problem in monetary terms. When push comes to shove and it's human lives on the line, then we should be looking in more human terms at an issue like climate change. And that's really what, in a sense, the back message of our paper is here are some ways in which you can look at climate change in very human and numerical terms. So in some ways, that's what I would wish for, is that we approach the climate problem like we're approaching the COVID-19 crisis, and we put human values and human considerations first. Because after all, what the economics of climate change is teaching us anyway is that tackling climate change could actually be an economic opportunity. I'm certainly in the camp that can see how the so-called Green New Deal is a positive for people and economics as well as the climate.
We've been speaking with Professor Tim Lenton, Director of Global Systems Institute at UK's University of Exeter. Find links to this publicly available article in the journal Nature and my previous interview of Tim about planetary tipping points in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you for sharing your time and insight with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.